The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 44.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Stay curious. Thank you for the super chat. You asked, how long until we see more housing inventory? A long time, because you've got to think, in order for there to be more inventory, you've got a lot of regulatory hurdles. You've got demand issues there, which could be gone because of the cerveza sickness. So a lot of moving parts, and you've got to get people out of their homes to actually build, to do the work, to take the risk as an entrepreneur. And I think over the next, call it at least 3 months, you're not going to see any housing inventory built. Now, there could be people selling, but I would assume that would be low as well, because very few sellers are going to want to sell into this market because there's just no buyers. They're thinking to themselves, I'm going to wait till this whole thing blows over. Then I'm going to put my house on the market to get that premium price that I was expecting just 30 days ago prior to the cerveza sickness taking over the whole world. So also I'd want to add, stay curious, that you've got to remember real estate prices are like a giant ship. They don't just crash overnight like the stock market. It takes a long time for those sellers to start adjusting down their price and for the buyers and the seller to come to kind of an equilibrium. That takes months most often. So I think you're trying to get at what is the home price or what the average price is going to do over the near term. And I think we'll just kind of have a freeze. And then longer term, we'll just have to see how much of a recession, or hopefully not a depression, but it could be that, how long and how severe that is. Baxter, thank you for the super chat. Says, I'm buying the stocks Jim Cramer suggested. And so far, I am 50 points in the red. What should I do? And this is a question I answered already. But Baxter, stop watching CNBC. Stop watching Jim Cramer. You can do it for entertainment purposes. But whatever you do, don't make stock selections on anyone's advice or a tip. You've got to start by asking yourself, is it cheap? Is it expensive? If so, then you buy it based on its historical average adjusted for inflation or the cash flow relative to what you would normally get on a treasury. That's where you have to start. You're already 50 points down. So if it were me, I would just cut my losses and try to start from scratch with a better mindset, but with a different mindset that asks different questions first. Forget about asking the question, which is all Jim Cramer does, is it going up or down in price? Just completely forget that question. Again, you start, is it cheap? Is it expensive? Go from there. Zoomer, thank you for the super chat. Don't you think US will come out stronger out of the end of this, and real estate market will boom due to low interest rates? I absolutely 100% do not think that. The U.S. could come out stronger. My guess is they won't, because they didn't take it as seriously as they should have at the beginning. You'll notice countries that kind of were nonchalant about this, i.e. Europe, are really struggling. And the countries that really took the bull by the horns right off the bat, like South Korea, Singapore, they've done very well on flattening out that curve, which I'm sure all of you have heard Dr. Chris Martinson reference on his videos. So I hope I'm wrong, but I would assume the U.S. looks more like Spain and Italy than Singapore, unfortunately. As far as the real estate market, no, because although I would agree lowering interest rates does give some tailwind to the market because it makes those mortgage payments cheaper. But you've got to remember what else has gone on, that home prices are at all-time highs. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the mortgage payments would be cheap even at 0% interest. The income has not kept up with the price, especially in these coastal markets. You guys know the ones I always talk about, the cyclical markets. But now it's even getting kind of bad in those linear markets as well. At some point in time, the home prices have to adjust back to their historic average. Going back to 1900, you guys know the chart that I always reference, adjusted for inflation, make sure of that. But I just don't see a boom because lowering the interest rates from an economic standpoint, what is that supposed to promote? That is supposed to bring demand from the future into the present. Well, how much more demand can we bring in from the future? Who is sitting on the sidelines at a 4% interest rate saying, darn it, if I could only get 20 more basis points, if I get it down to 3.8, then I would definitely pull the trigger. No one's really saying that. And at a certain point, mortgage rates don't exactly follow the 10-year. We could have a situation where the 10-year is going down and mortgage rates might not budge. So I don't think the mortgage rates are going to affect the monthly payment enough to make it affordable for enough people to get that boom or that massive increase in demand that you might be expecting. So I would be surprised if the real estate market is at the same level in a year. And I would assume that it would be lower, if anything, in the next year, because it just, at some point in time, the prices have to match up with the income. And the income has done this, and the prices have done this. Master Meep, thank you for the super chat. Trump emphasizing Chinese virus. Do you think we are setting them up as a scapegoat in order to go to war when our economy collapses further? Unfortunately, this is kind of the standard operating procedure, not just for the United States, but a lot of countries, but we're very good at it. In the sense that when we have a problem or an issue, we always look at the other guy. Well, it's got to be those foreigners. They've got a different religion. They smell funny. They eat different food. They're completely different. And I think it's a little worse for Americans because, unfortunately, not a lot of Americans go outside of the country to see that whether you're in Europe, you might be in Africa, Australia, in all these Asia somewhere. People, yeah, on the margin are different, but as a whole, listen, they're just like you. They're going to be pretty hardworking. They're going to put their family first as far as their priorities, their spouse, their kid. 90% of it's pretty much the same. So it's a neat scapegoat to your point. I hate it. I don't like it. I think it's a flaw in the human condition, if you will, but it is what it is. We can be very tribal, unfortunately. And I don't know if Trump is emphasizing the Chinese thing on purpose. I don't know. I don't really get into the name thing. I know that that's in the media right now in the United States. That's like a big deal. I think we got bigger fish to fry. I don't care if you want to call it the alien virus, the Indian virus, the US virus, the George virus, the CNBC virus. I don't care what you call it. That's just, if we're worrying about that as opposed to the virus itself, we're taking up way, way, way too much mental bandwidth that should be allocated to really solving the problem. It's like your house being on fire and you worrying about the toilet being clogged. Probably not a good use of your time. Chadism, thank you for the super chat. Would you go long the dollar, farmland, or buy gold? This is where we've got to get in the right frame of mind. So we want to eliminate the question, is it going up in price or down in price? And ask, is it cheap or is it expensive? So the dollar right now, is it cheap? No, it is not cheap, historically speaking. That doesn't mean I disagree with Brent Johnson or Jeff Snyder. I mean, these guys know 100 times more than I do on the topic. It's just that I don't think we should put ourselves in that category. We're not professional investors. We don't do this for a living. My point is, guys like Brent and Jeff, their job is to try to figure out where the dollar is going over the next 3 months. That's extremely difficult to do. Either of them, I think, would admit that in a heartbeat. We're never going to be that good. I know I'm not. So all I can do is forget what's going on in the next 3 months. I like to think about it, and I like to pay attention to it. I like to understand it. But as far as me actually allocating my portfolio, I'm looking 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road. That's really all I can handle with any type of confidence. So then the question becomes, is the United States dollar cheap, historically speaking, when I look out over the next 5 years or 10 years? No, it's not. So I'm not a buyer, plain and simple. Moving on to farmland, I think that could be extremely interesting. I would warn you against going into property that could be illiquid. That's a big mistake that I made when I first got into real estate. And I much prefer to buy already built residential properties because they're throwing off cash flow and they're far more liquid. They have two buyers. You have an investor and you have an owner-occupant. With farmland, you're really going to have one buyer. That's a farmer or someone who wants to somehow use that land to produce income. So my point is I would shy away from just land. But if it's producing farmland, maybe it's a small farm where they're growing blackberries or walnuts or maybe a dairy farm, something like that, and it's actually throwing off cash flow, then I'd look at what they're asking per acre. I'd look at that historically, do the exact same analysis. Is it cheap? Then I'd look at that cash flow relative to what other investments I could get or what I would consider a good return on my money, even at any point in time, whether it's during zero interest rate policy time or during Fed funds at 5 or 6. So I would want 10%+. If I get 12, 14%, 15% on as far as positive cash flow on a piece of farmland and per acre, it's relatively cheap, historically speaking, I'm all about it. I think it's a fantastic deal. As far as gold, gold is the only asset where I really don't ask myself that question. Is it cheap? Because I'm only buying it to maintain my purchasing power. That's it. I'm not buying it to get rich. I'm buying it to stay rich. Big, big difference. So if I make an extra $100,000 in a month or a year or whatever, I'm not asking myself, what's the price of gold? I don't care. Whatever the price of gold is, I'm going to buy $10,000 worth of physical gold. With the other $90,000, then yes, I'm not, as far as an investment or a speculation, I'm going to start asking those questions. But gold is unique in that aspect. So again, it's all about mindset, and hopefully that makes sense. Funding Jim, thank you for the super chat. 4 safe rental areas to buy within 6 months for cash flow. This was a difficult question for me to answer before, and because it's just so much of an unknown what's going to be happening over the next 2 or 3 months in residential real estate. Like I said earlier, most likely the prices will just freeze. And real estate prices really don't go down or up that quickly. But I've never seen this type of black swan event. Maybe this time it's different. I don't know. So if it were me, I would look at the numbers. And if it made a lot of sense right now, as far as the cash flow, the RV ratio, everything that we talk about, and I had just a perfect property, I had a motivated seller, it was just boom, this is ideal. Great neighborhood, great school district. I'd go ahead and pull the trigger, but if not, I'd hold off. Areas, of course, like Kansas City, the Missouri side. And then for the other markets, I don't have a lot of experience. What I would suggest doing is just going to my buddy's website, jasonhartman.com. He knows a lot more about other linear markets than I do. I would just see where he has inventory. And if you want to potentially buy one of his properties, great. But I would just really look at where he's doing business, and that's where I'd start. So if it's in Indianapolis, if it's a Little Rock, if it's, or else I think he might be in an area in northern Florida. I'm not quite sure, but that's where I'd start looking, is Jason's website, just to get market ideas. But to be clear, if I didn't have an absolutely perfect property lined up right now, I would hold off at least 2 or 3 months to see how this starts to play out. Because the last thing you want to do is buy something right now if the United States goes into a situation like Italy. Hi, Visual Viz Economist. Thank you for the super chat. I think this might be very important. S&P and Dow up 0.75 today. NASDAQ up 2.3%. Russell up 7%. I have never seen this divergence. Did Fed equity purchases do this? Would Fed only buy domestic companies? I definitely think they're going to want to buy companies who are domiciled in the United States. That's for sure. As far as them getting specific on the Russell, I don't know. And I was going through the four-letter acronyms for my video, and one of them is PDFC, and that's a primary dealer. Or I'm sorry, it might be the PDCF, I believe. So primary dealer credit facility. This is where they start to buy any asset from the primary dealers, including stocks. And to me, it's pretty much obvious that this is a plunge protection team type of strategy. They're not saying that. They're just saying that, oh, it's just temporary. We're just going to take some assets off the primary dealer's balance sheet to add liquidity to the system. But if you look at what actually happens to the balance sheet, the Fed or the primary dealers could buy shares in XYZ company. That goes onto they do that with excess reserves. That goes onto their balance sheet. Then they say, hey, Fed, we need to go to the primary dealer credit facility and we need to lend you, or we need to borrow money against these shares. So what ends up happening? The Fed prints money. The cash goes onto the balance sheet of the primary dealers. And where do these stocks go? They go to the balance sheet of the Fed. So how is that not the Fed buying shares? Now, a Steve Leisman would say, oh, no, it's just temporary, George, just temporary. Don't worry, just temporary. Okay, so is quantitative easing. That was just temporary, right? And what was quantitative easing? That's when the Fed was buying assets, treasuries, or mortgage-backed securities from the primary dealers. Same thing. It was just supposed to be this temporary thing, and they're not buying them. No. Because it's just going to be on our balance sheet for a couple months, and we're going to sell them right back into the market just when things calm down a little bit. All right, well, that was 2008. It's now 2020, 12 years later, and a lot of those treasuries are still, in fact, most of those treasuries are still on the Fed's balance sheet. So how did they not just buy those treasuries? I think you could see the exact same thing happen with all of the shares that they put onto their balance sheet as collateral from the primary dealers, in that if the shares continue to go down, the primary dealers and everyone else is going to have 100 cents on the dollar, and those assets will just continue to go down on the Fed's balance sheet. And since they don't have a profit or loss, who cares? I think that's kind of the game plan here. Tyler, thank you for the super chat. Do you think the U.S. will see negative Fed target rate in 2020? Most likely. Nothing's a certainty. I would say the probabilities are there now because the short-term T-bills, and nobody's talking about this in the media. I'm really surprised. I've only heard Jeff Snyder mention it on his Twitter feed. So if you're not following Jeff Snyder, make sure you do that. But he pointed out that the four-week T-bill actually went negative last night. If the T-bills are going negative, I think the Fed has to follow. I don't think they have a choice with the Fed funds rate, to be clear. We'll see. The next question becomes, do we think that the T-bills will continue to see tremendous demand because they're the pristine collateral. And as long as we're having the issues with the Cerveza sickness, I think the answer there is definitely yes. So I would say there's probably at least a 60-40% chance that they go negative. Although, yeah, because I think they've got to follow the short end of the yield curve. I'd have to think that through. But if the T-bills are going negative, I think that would pose a big problem for them if they didn't go negative as well. That's a weird yield curve, isn't it? Because you got the long end of the yield curve going up. You've got the middle kind of there, the short end way down, and then Fed funds. Yeah, that's a good question for Jeff Snyder, actually. But bottom line is, yes, I think there's at least a 60% chance that they will go negative with the Fed funds rate, but it's definitely not 100%. Dimitri, thank you for the super chat. George, do you recommend 1 month T-bills to protect your money? What do you do if they start producing a negative yield, 3 month? This is a fantastic question. This was really hard for me to answer. As of 30 days ago, for me, it was a no-brainer when you're getting 1.5 or what, 2% on a three-month T-bill. Now, if it goes negative, that's a whole different ballgame. What are your options? I think it depends on how much I had. So I definitely don't want more than $250 in an individual bank account because I'm not going to be covered with FDIC. As you guys know, I'm not a big fan of FDIC. I don't think you should put your confidence, because they've only got $100 billion to insure $10 trillion in deposits. That doesn't make me feel any better. I do think they'd get a bailout, but I don't want to gamble on that. So that's why I preferred short-term treasuries or T-bills. But with a negative yield, I think if I had under $250, especially like under $100, I'd rather have that in a checking account. If I have over $250, maybe I keep a bit in the checking account and keep the rest in the T-bills. But unfortunately, it's like, it's an impossible question to answer because there's just no good solutions. It's just either you pick the terrible route or the horrible route. It's like, it's just the Fed. They've put us into this position where the only alternative is to lose money. It's just, or take way too much risk. Just terrible. Figuring out money. Thank you for the super chat. Can you talk about the correlation between the gold-silver ratio and the Fed balance sheet chart? I discussed this recently and want your input. I've spoken to Rick Rule and Peter Schiff. They have different views on this. Rick is under the belief that the gold-silver ratio really doesn't affect the price. It's really not a leading indicator. Schiff thinks that it may be. And this is per my interviews that I've done with them in the past. Peter's will be out this weekend on Saturday, the full interview. But Rick's, you can see, that's already up on the YouTube channel. So I don't know if there's a correlation or there's a causal effect that we may be able to use as a speculative guide as far as buying silver. I'm assuming that's what your price is really, or what your question's about is really the silver price. And how those two would be correlated to the Fed's balance sheet, I'm not sure. I think if you're saying the size of the Fed's balance sheet in relationship to both the gold and silver price, then yeah, I think there's something there. But as far as if there's like a three-way correlation between the three, I'm not sure I'm aware of that. That wouldn't make a lot of sense to me. Might be more coincidence if there's something that you may see in the charts. So takeaway is, I think silver is a good price. I've been looking at silver charts lately for myself, and it's not super, super cheap. Back in 2000 or 1998, it was down like $6-7 an ounce. I would rather buy at those prices, but 10, 11 is still under its historic norm, adjusted for inflation. But I don't know if I'd call it really super, super cheap. So I'm not saying don't buy it right now, because when you compare the silver price to itself, or when you just compare the silver price to the Fed's balance sheet, then yes, I agree, it could be considered a good value. But again, you're looking at the silver price compared to itself and not necessarily compared to the price of gold. Abby, thank you for the super chat. I'm all cash, planning on buying S&P between 1700 and 2000. What is your guess at S&P bottom? I want to make sure that you're using some rationale and some data-backed thinking to come to the conclusion of 17 or 2000. I mean, that those numbers are so far apart, it seems like you're kind of like guessing a little bit. We don't want to do that. As an example, if you went back and looked at the low on the S&P in 2008-09, and then you adjusted it for inflation, and that's where you're getting that 1700 number, then I think that's great. But I don't know. I think it got down below 700. So adjusted for inflation, it's not going to be all the way up at 1700. I think maybe 1200 at the most, but probably lower than that. So as far as the S&P itself being super, super, super cheap, a bottom, I would look a lot lower than 1700. It's not to say that it won't bottom out there. Who knows? The Fed could come in and start buying stocks. That'll most likely put a floor on it. But if they don't, I think that you've got to look at what we landed on or where we stopped in 2008-09, adjust that for inflation and start there. Brad, thank you for the super chat. George, what are your thoughts on refinance, cash out refi for investment, primary property, short, long term? I think that's a great deal right now. I'm actually looking to do that with some of my properties in the United States. I think that if or when this gets really bad, the cerveza sickness in the U.S., I don't think banks will lend to anybody. I don't care if you have I don't care what your credit score is. I don't care if you own 100% of the asset and you just want a 50% LTV line of credit. I don't think they're going to go for it. Everything is going to lock up, in my opinion. So if you can pull out some dry powder from one of your properties and lock it in at like a 4% interest rate, I think that is interesting. It's something that I'm doing right now myself, like I said. So I think if you're smart about it. Now, Brad, if you're going to be stretching yourself thin to make those mortgage payments, if they're not producing a yield immediately, because even if you buy a dividend paying stock, they could cut the dividend. You might have to float those carrying costs, which would be your mortgage payment, for a year, who knows how long. So as long as you've got a great job or you're very, well, I mean, who does in this environment? But as long as maybe you're self-employed, maybe you work online, maybe you've got quite a bit of savings and you can weather out 3 months of this, then I would totally consider that. If you're someone that's maybe struggling a little bit more, then and you don't have a lot of cash flow coming in to cover those carrying costs, then I would think twice. Wally, thank you for the super chat. It looks like the dollar milkshake theory is going to come to pass, but it seems it may come fast and short-lived. What are your thoughts? I don't want to have any recency bias there. I'm not saying that Brent's wrong. It looks like he very well could be right. A lot of smart people see it that way. Jeff Snyder, Raul Paul with Real Vision. I can totally see the argument for the dollar going to 140 on the DXY. I can also see the argument for it going to 50. I'm just not good enough to weigh those odds other than 50-50, to be honest with you. But I think it's important we understand the argument. Very crucial. So where I'm going with that is if you understand the argument, you understand if the dollar goes up to 110, 120 on the DXY, it's going to wreak havoc on other economies outside the U.S., which because everyone is so synergistically connected now, that will have a ripple effect back to the U.S., whether it's exports, imports, what have you. Because all these countries loaded up on dollar-denominated debt and corporations outside the United States, back when the DXY was at 70 and they're in this ZERP policy, they've got to roll over that debt. They potentially do it at a higher interest rate, but they don't have the dollars to pay off that dollar-denominated debt because their revenue is coming in their own local currency. If you have a country like Colombia that has a lot of its revenue coming in dollars because of the oil, that's better. But unfortunately now we have oil at, call it $25 a barrel. So if you were selling it 30 days ago at $50 a barrel, you would have a lot more dollars coming in to pay off that dollar-denominated debt. If we get into this situation where we go into low oil for an extended period of time, call it 2-3 months, that's going to make it really hard on these other countries. There's going to be a lot of demand for dollars. And I totally get the argument. The counter argument to that would be Peter Schiff saying, you're right, I totally get it, Brent, but the Fed's going to print so much money that it's going to completely overwhelm the demand. And whether it's looking at it from a standpoint of Triffin's paradox or whatever, or the Fed just not, or just needing to print so much money to prop up the U.S. economy, that could be it as well. Especially when you consider the fact that the balance sheet of the Fed, I mean, it could go to $10 trillion easy in the next few months. And after that, who knows? If we go into a depression where they've got to peg the yield curve, but we go into an inflationary recession or an inflationary depression, how much money will they have to print to peg that yield curve when the market wants to drive those rates up? Who knows? It could go $20 trillion in the next year or so. I mean, think about it. They're doing $1 trillion a day in repo right now. And I know that's not getting out into the market. Let me be clear. They're not injecting that, but they're committing. Not that the demand is there, but they're committing to $1 trillion a day. If you would, even Schiff, the biggest, I don't care, pick them, the biggest bear out there. If you would have asked them 5 months ago if the Fed would be committing to $1 trillion a day in repo, they would have said, no way. That even goes beyond my wildest expectations. And me, I'm talking, not me, George Gammon, but whoever you think of the biggest bear, whoever that is, he or she, I don't think even they could have expected something like this. So I don't think that a Fed balance sheet of $10 trillion in the next 6 months or $20 trillion in the next year or two is out of the question. I think you've got to consider it. Dwazi, thank you for the super chat. How high dollar going before Fed print can drop it? Well, it goes back to that last question I just answered. I don't know. And I'm interviewing Brent on Tuesday. This is definitely something I'll discuss with him. So make sure you guys stay tuned for another full-length interview with Brent Johnson next week. I interviewed him probably a month and a half ago. And obviously, what's going on with just a total collapse of the Aussie dollar. And that's something that everyone should be paying attention to as well. I don't know if you guys heard that, but the Aussie dollar dropped by 20% or so just overnight. That's like a Banana Republic Venezuela type thing, let alone a normal developed economy like Australia. That is still, this kind of blows my mind. But this could really get out of hand. I mean, we could see things in the next month that we never ever thought we'd see, just like the last 2 or 3 weeks. But as far as on the DXY, I don't know, buddy. I think if it's getting up to 110, 120, that's putting a lot of stress on the worldwide economy. And at that point, they may come in with like a Plaza Accord 2.0, where the Fed has to go into the currency markets and just flood them to get the dollar down. Mr. Fusion, thank you for the super chat. When is a good time to buy hotel, MGM, Sands, casinos, cruise lines, stocks? At these prices, it feels like stealing money. I agree long term. What I'm hesitant about is if they can stay in business. Remember, Sands almost went BK, belly up, in 2009. I mean, I think their share price is like a dollar, if I'm not mistaken, but they were right on the cusp. And I think this Cerveza sickness is going to be even harder on them. If I was dabbling in the casino stocks, I would look at who has the most exposure to Macau, and I would be more likely to pull the trigger on one of those. And I think that would be Las Vegas Sands. Not only that, they've got big exposure in Singapore. I've stayed at their hotel, the Marina Bay Sands, there quite often. They do a ton of business. And Singapore's, I don't want to say they're back to normal, but they're not shutting down their economy. So there's going to be people there gambling. Macau, I think that China hopefully if they don't get a second wave of this, they're going to be back to spending money a lot faster than the United States. So if you're like a Caesars who or an MGM who has exposure to China, but their bread and butter is really Vegas, I would shy away from those for sure. The cruise lines, again, you got to worry about them going bankrupt. Do they get a bailout? I wouldn't bet on it. I still have them on a watch list. I would wait. I'm personally waiting until I see some sort of catalyst that can move the narrative for the cerveza sickness in the United States in a different direction. And right now, I don't see that. Smash Brothers, thank you for the super chats. What's your take on the airline stocks? Airlines are a necessity, not like a cruise operator. I'm concerned about government bailout diluting shares. Yeah, I don't like the airline stocks too much. And I know they're cheap or will be cheap. Even if they stay in business, I think they're going to need a bailout. And that bailout is going to come with some really crazy stipulations from the government. And I think Schiff is right on the money here, that it's going to make them less competitive in the future. And I don't want to be a part of that. And airline stocks are notoriously bad. I'd rather look into oil than airline stocks. RW, thank you for the super chat. How will Friday upcoming triple witching hour impact the stock market? The triple witching hour. I think you're talking about the Fed. I think I saw that in a news article. What were they referring to? I think it has something to do with the repo and all these markets converging at once where they're committing to all this money. I think that's what it is. Actually, refers to stock index futures, options on individual stocks expiring simultaneously. I see what you're saying. I don't think that's going to be a big issue this time because the Fed has just committed to trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and quadrillions of dollars in liquidity. And they're setting up all of these four-letter acronyms with the primary dealers. And they're dropping the discount window. So that means that the non-primary dealers can access it. So I don't see that being an issue. I think that's my short answer. I could be wrong, though. But I would say with 60, 70% confidence, I don't really see that being too much of an issue. Cliffhanger, thank you for the super chat. Hi, George. Just got a good deal on a ute. It's an inflation hedge, potential home, and out of the banking system. Good idea. Oh, you're from Oz. Oh, okay. That makes a lot more sense now that you threw me for one there. So for those of you outside of Australia, and Cliffhanger, in the comments, correct me if I'm wrong, a ute is one of these little truck type things. We really don't have them too much in the United States. Although old school guys and gals in the States, you'll remember like the Subaru Brat, I think it was. I think that would be, the Aussies would consider that a ute. So the front of it is like a car, but the back of it's like a little pickup, kind of like a El Camino type thing. But they're smaller. And in Australia, they love to soup them up like muscle cars and put like 700 horsepower in them, which is really cool. But great idea, Cliffhanger, especially right now with what's happening to the Aussie dollar. You've got to get inflation hedges. And you've got to get them outside of the banking system and outside of the real estate market because we know that's in a massive bubble. So, as you know, I love the diesel trucks in the United States, the Fords between 94 and 2002, the 460s and the 73s. And that's basically the Australian version of that. So, I give you a big thumbs up. Showtime, thank you for the super chat. Forced closure and likely bankruptcy of hundreds of profitable and unprofitable businesses. Yep, got it. Shareholder wipeout for the most part if government bailout. I think your question is if the government doesn't bail them out. And yes, for sure. If the government doesn't bail out businesses, we're going to have huge bankruptcies. At least, I don't want to talk in certainty, but the probabilities are high that we have huge businesses and small businesses, but a large amount of them going bust, and it's going to wipe out shareholder equity for sure. I think they should go bust because that's capitalism at work. And I'm not a big fan, nor was I ever a fan, of the bailouts in 2008, 2009. I don't care if this is a force majeure or whatever you want to call it. It's not their fault. It kind of, I mean, it is and it isn't. It kind of is your fault, because, meaning the businesses and the individuals who struggle with this, because you don't have 6 months of savings. And I know for the average Joe, that's really hard to do, especially when the Fed keeps pumping up inflation for stable prices, and it puts you behind the eight ball, because the only way that you can get ahead, or one of the only ways, the fastest way to get ahead, is to have your money in assets, and you're just putting your money into asset bubbles that when they pop, you're screwed. But as far as the businesses themselves, they shouldn't have been buying back all these shares. They should have been, they should have had plenty of cash on their balance sheet to weather the storm. And since they didn't, they should go out of business, and new owners should take them over that were prudent enough to have the money to buy them. That's how I see the bailout. I totally agree with Peter Schiff in that department, for sure. Jim, thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, if the divergence between paper and physical, will this result in the end of the COMEX? If so, how will we be able to price spot gold moving forward? I don't know enough about that to give you a professional answer. Anything I say right here would be a guess. So I'm trying to think it through here. I don't think it's the end of the COMEX. I think at some point there's it's got to equal out, but I don't think it would be the end. So I think that I'm going to go with that question. But keep in mind, Jim, I'm not an expert on anything for that matter. Keep in mind, guys, I almost flunked out of high school, never taken an econ class or a finance class. I'm just all self-taught. So I am literally not an expert at anything except for maybe real estate business. But I would try to do some research with some people who know that better than I do, Jim. Robin, thank you for the super chat. Question, aren't mortgage-backed securities going bankrupt? Fannie Freddie and people who are buying homes at too high of a price. Robin, keep in mind that even if the MBSs struggle and we have defaults, that was the pin that broke the bubble back in 2008-9. It wasn't necessarily the heart of the problem. I know that sounds very weird and counterintuitive to say that, but there was a lot of underlying flaws in the system that created the last financial crisis. And the mortgage-backed securities, that was the catalyst. So I don't want to get too fixated on them right now. That said, I totally agree with what you're saying. People are paying way too high a price for homes, especially in markets on the coast where they're paying higher prices than they did in 2006-7, adjusted for inflation. If those come crashing down, you're right, they could. See, a lot of people make the mistake of assuming that the loans are a lot more, they've been, that the lending standards have improved dramatically since 2005 and 6. I think that's the best way to say it. I don't know where they're getting this information. I think that's something that people are just, like, everyone is saying it, so it must be true. Granted, they might not have the liar loans. That was a small percentage of the market back in 2004, 5, 6, 7. But if you look at the average down payment of a home today compared to what it was in 2005, it's almost identical. It's only about 5 or 6%. So it's not like, if you listen to the narrative with all your friends and family members or media or even smart people out there, the narrative is always, oh, the lending standards are so much better. Like, the average down payment now is 20 or 25%, and back in 2005, it was zero. No. It's maybe 6 now, and maybe 5 or 4 back in 2005. So it's not that big of a difference. Lending standards aren't that great, especially considering the fact that we may go into a, who knows, maybe a depression where unemployment goes up into double digits, 12%. Then what's going to happen to those? So they, the fly in the ointment in 2005 and 2008-9, when these things blew up, was people's ability to make the payments. When those rates adjusted on those adjustable rate mortgages, people couldn't afford the payment. All the buyers left, and the market collapses. So it's not necessarily an interest rate issue, more so someone's ability to pay issue. So if we have unemployment go from 3 or 4% up to 12, 14%, that could have the same type of effect that those adjustable rate mortgages had back in 2000, whatever, 5, 6, 7. People just can't afford to pay them. So you get the high defaults, and that's what brings down those mortgage-backed securities or whatever else, the CDSs, the credit default swaps that are insurance against those, or maybe the CDOs, what have you. Hi-Viz Economist, thank you for the super chat. Says tinfoil hat time. Woo! All right, strap in, buddy. What happened to Ray Dalio shorting the market with the $1.5 billion? Didn't that exactly expire in March? What if he had an inside source in the ground in China? Well, I don't know, because if you look at his overall, his main portfolio, if I'm not mistaken, he took about a 20% haircut. So if he had insider information, he sure didn't take advantage of it. Although he probably made a ton on the, I'm guessing he had puts maybe, something like that, on the S&P with the $1.5 billion. Whatever it was, it didn't compensate for the losses that he had in the other areas of his portfolio. From what I've seen in the headlines, I haven't researched it extensively, but I think he took a big haircut. So, although you're insinuating that he may have had some insider information with China, that very well could be true. I know that I watched a lot of the interviews from Davos or whatever the goofy convention was that all the rich people or the billionaires and CEOs maybe 2 months ago. And I heard guys like Dalio mention the coronavirus. So I don't know if he had insider information or he just had people on the ground and he was just paying attention to it. He got that information first and was warned about it. And therefore, that was the rationale behind that $1.5 billion bet. But obviously, he didn't pay enough attention to it. Polonius, thank you for the super chat. When will gold silver see a boom? Well, I mean, who knows on the timing? We have to look at the 5-year, 10-year time horizon. And I'm pretty confident that gold and silver will be higher in 5 or 10 years. Will it be higher in real terms? I don't know. Could just keep up with inflation. That's something you've got to consider. And going back to my insurance policy, gold, in my opinion, isn't a way to get rich. It's a way to stay rich. From a short-term trading standpoint, I think that the markets have to settle down and the collateral issue or liquidity issue or counterparty risk issue, whatever is causing these dollar funding markets like repo to just go completely nuts, that needs to settle down before I think gold will really catch a bid. And I think once it does settle down, whether that's a week, a month, 6 months, I don't know, and people don't have to continually sell their gold whether it's a margin call or to come up with liquidity because they don't have any other collateral. Based on 2008, and plus the Fed taking the balance sheet to call it $10 trillion, that's going to put a lot of upward pressure on gold. And we could see, I think we most likely will see a bull market in gold over the next 3 years. But you're going to have to wait out the volatility in the market and to where it kind of bottoms out, in my opinion, before you start to see that big upshot. And I could be way off. I'm just basing that on what happened in 2008. Steven, thank you for the super chat. Why don't you stream from your website? I had no idea that was an option, Steven. So I'll put that on my to-do list and I'll go over that with Sebastian. I don't know how the heck we would do that, but unfortunately we're on Wix just because it's easier to, the back end's a little easier for us to change it. We tried WordPress and that was a nightmare. I know it's better, but just from a user standpoint, I couldn't figure that out. So I don't know if Wix has that functionality or not. Toro, thank you for the super chat. George, let's go into the primary dealer business. Yeah, no kidding. No kidding, my friend. Yeah, if you can't beat them, join them, right? Nah, I don't think I'd ever come to that. No matter how much money I could make, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't stand waking up every morning knowing that I was helping to facilitate the actions of the Fed, which are at the core of so many problems we have in the United States. I couldn't do it. But that's it for now, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.